It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC. In September of 1953, No Kum Suk, the youngest pilot in the North Korean Air Force, flew his MiG-15 fighter jet from his home base in Pyongyang and into South Korea. He didn't take his flight to attack, but instead to defect. In doing so, he gave the United States access to what was, at the time, state-of-the-art Soviet-made aviation technology. This international incident on the very heels of the Korean War coincided with the beginning of what has been a long Cold War between an increasingly isolated North Korea and the United States. The roots of what many call a rogue nation are on display in former Washington Post correspondent Blaine Harden's book, The Great Leader and the Fighter Pilot. Harden profiles two men in the book, the defecting pilot and the then-emerging leader whose family still controls North Korea to this day. And we welcome Blaine Harden to the show. Blaine, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be here.
So what was the significance of those Soviet MiG fighters like No Kum Suk flew to South Korea to North Korea's Air Force? What did that particular bit of machinery mean to North Korea?
Well, it was at the time, it was the hottest fighter jet in the communist world, and only behind the American F-86 Sabre in its speed and ability to climb. What the plane was particularly good at was shooting down big bombers like the B-29, which the Americans were using during the Korean War to bomb North Korea and bomb Chinese supply lines. And the MiGs, when they first appeared in the battlefield, in the skies, they were incredibly lethal. They shot down a number of B-29s in a matter of days, and the Americans then had to scramble their best fighter jets from the United States and get them there, and then they began the first all-jet air war in world history.
How old was No Kum Suk when he defected?
He was only 21, and he began training as a fighter pilot when he was 18, and he was the youngest fighter pilot in the North Korean Air Force. And he was trained fairly well, but he still was no measure for the Americans who had sometimes twice or three times, four times as many hours in their aircraft as he did.
He says from the very beginning of his service, his intent was to steal a plane and fly away. That's why he wanted to become a pilot.
That's right. He was looking for an escape module from North Korea. He really didn't want to live in communist North Korea. He didn't want to live under the great leader, Kim Il-sung. So he joined the Navy thinking that he might be able to swipe a patrol boat. But before he ever got trained and ever got near a boat, he asked if he could volunteer for the Air Force. And he found a much faster escape module that only accommodated one person, which is exactly what he wanted.
Well, when he did escape, he just got in his plane and flew pretty much undetected by the U.S. Air Force to South Korea. You know, this is on the heels of a war. This is a protected zone that the United States Air Force is monitoring. How did he fly undetected from Pyongyang to one of the busiest areas of South Korea?
Well, he was very, very lucky. That morning at Gimpo Air Force Base, the U.S. Air Force Base where most of the fighter jets were, that morning they turned off their radar for routine repairs. This was 7 weeks after the war was over. They still had lots of F-86 scrambled and were flying around the area, but with no radar to see this jet coming in, and it came in straight from the north with the wind and landed with the wind the wrong way on the landing strip at the airport. They just didn't see him coming. And the first they knew that he was there, he was on the ground. He was extremely lucky.
It was quite a scene when he did come in the wrong way, landing the opposite of the direction that air traffic was sending aircraft on that landing strip. He almost collided with another aircraft, I guess.
Yeah, he came in. He tried to time it so that he could land without a head-on collision, but he got it wrong. And another jet, an F-86, was landing directly with, you know, his nose looking right at him as they both came in at about 140 miles an hour. And No Kum Suk had some experience in landing against another airplane in the small airstrips that they used in Manchuria. But the American pilot, he was utterly shocked when he saw this other plane landing the wrong way. And he shouted over the radio that there's a plane coming in the wrong way, and he managed to steer to the right enough to hit it. And when he passed it, he swiveled his head, and he shouted over the radio. He shouted, "It's a goddamn MiG." And that was really the first general alert that there was a MiG in the area.
We're talking with Blaine Harden. He is the author of The Great Leader and the Fighter Pilot, which tells the story of a North Korean pilot who defected to South Korea and the beginnings of what we now know as the totalitarian regime in North Korea as well. So to get in the position to become a fighter pilot for the North Korean Air Force, Nokum-suk carried on a charade that he, in fact, was a fervent communist. Was that necessary to get the type of assignment that he wanted to get flight training so he could then eventually steal a plane?
It was absolutely necessary. Being a really good pilot was not nearly enough in North Korea. You had to be a believer, or you had to appear to be a believer to be trusted enough to get in a Soviet-made plane that would allow you to escape. So he spent a lot of time and had a lot of heartache trying to project this image as a number one communist. To do it, he was very noisy in meetings. They had indoctrination meetings almost every day, and he would praise the great leader for his brilliance and his genius, and also praise Joseph Stalin, who was the great leader's model. And then he would denounce other pilots and low-level superiors of his for insufficient zeal to the leaders and insufficient interest in saving fuel, taking care of the planes in the right way. So he basically was a total kiss-up to the leadership, and they bought it. But he constantly worried that they were seeing through him and knew what a phony liar he really was. And when he landed at Gimpo and had his interrogation and then sort of calmed down, it took him years, basically, before he could convince himself that there weren't people who knew he was a liar and who were going to come after him and kill him.
Well, the great leader that you speak of, and the great leader mentioned in the book's title, is Kim Il-sung, who is Kim Jong-un, the current leader of North Korea. That's his grandfather.
That's right.
He came to power, and of course his family has maintained power remarkably for such an isolationist nation and a totalitarian regime for now three generations. During the war, Kim Il-sung had a great deal of help from China and the Soviet Union. But after that, you know, they became even more isolated from those forces and became less of a puppet regime. How did Kim Il-sung build up his power and cozy up to Stalin?
Well, there were a couple phases in his leadership. He was brought into North Korea in 1945 because he'd been a successful fighter against the Japanese colonial powers, which all the Koreans hated in the Korean Peninsula. So he had a certain street credibility, and so the Soviet generals and Stalin chose Kim Il-sung because he seemed like a puppet with a reputation, and he was pliable. He'd been reading about Stalinism, and he liked the tools that Stalinists used, the repressive tools. So they put him in power thinking that this young man, and he was only about 32 when they put him in power, that he would be a useful puppet for them. But Kim Il-sung also very much wanted to go to war against South Korea to unite the entire peninsula under the Soviets and under his control. So he persuaded Stalin to go to war, and the war started in 1950. And for a few weeks, Kim Il-sung was like a military genius. They took most of the Korean peninsula. But then his army got overextended. They didn't have the right supply lines. The Americans fought back and cut his army in half and mostly destroyed it. At that point, it was the Korean War that he started, but Kim Il-sung was basically pushed out of any involvement in the war. He sort of stood on the sidelines and lived underground as the Americans bombed North Korea. And the Chinese came in and fought the war on the ground. And the air war, such as it was, the Soviets protected the Chinese troops and their supply lines over a small slice of North Korea, and that was the Soviet operation. So Kim Il-sung basically just bided his time until the war was over. And then what he did was he really asserted his great genius, really, was as both a demagogue, the ability to support from the peasant population, and the ability to find enemies and kill them. He purged all of his enemies with show trials, with executions, with betrayal. And by the mid-1950s, he basically created the North Korea that we know now.
As you mentioned, he was a fan of Stalin. He liked Stalin's style, so apparently.
He liked everything about Stalin. He imitated everything that Stalin did. In fact, he out-Stalin Stalin. He did it more cruelly, and it lasted so much longer. His state has lasted more than twice as long as Stalin. You know, he had concentration camps, sorting the population based on political loyalty, complete control of the military, complete control of the economy, and complete control of information. So people could not move. They could only read what he wanted them to read, and they could not leave the country. And those are the same rules that North Korea still abides by under the third generation of leadership.
We're talking with Blaine Hardin. He is the author of The Great Leader and the Fighter Pilot, which tells the story of the Kim family, Kim Il-sung, the founder of what we think of now as modern North Korea. Of course, his family has ruled in a totalitarian state, very isolationist since then. Well, for those that are just joining us, the story you tell is really a parallel story. It's one of a young North Korean fighter pilot, Nokum Suk, who stole a MiG fighter, flew it to South Korea, put it in the hands of the Americans, and also the story of the man who started what we consider to be the modern regime, although it's not very modern, of North Korea, Kim Il-sung. He is Kim Jong-un's grandfather. And we had discussed how Kim had great success early on sort of recruiting allies amongst Russia and China to invade South Korea and start the Korean War. But mismanagement of that war basically ended up putting combat into the hands of the Chinese. Is that why the Chinese kind of split a little bit with North Korea? Chairman Mao apparently was no fan of Kim.
No, he wasn't. He basically thought that Kim Il-sung was a fat fool and said as much to people that I've talked to. But Mao and the Chinese had a debt to pay to Korea. Fighters from Korea had helped the Chinese communists in their long civil war against Chiang Kai-shek. And that is one of the reasons that Mao felt that he needed to come into that war and knock the Americans back to the 38th parallel. But also Mao was worried, a more existential threat for the Chinese government, is he was worried that General MacArthur and the Americans might move across the border from North Korea into Manchuria, northeastern China. So he preferred to fight the Americans inside the Korean Peninsula, where the damage would be outside of his country, and he thought it would be easier to do it that way. But the Chinese sacrificed it. Probably hundreds of thousands of lives. They used human wave tactics against the Americans. They've never been precise about how many soldiers were killed. The legacy of that war is that the Chinese leadership to this day is very wary of a United States-supported Korea on its border. And so that's why it puts up with a North Korea that is a bit of an embarrassment. It's a buffer between South Korea, which is allied with the United States. I think South Korea and China have now become strong trading partners, and which is somewhat isolating North Korea. But still, China wants to have a North Korea buffer between the United States and South Korea.
Well, somewhat ironically, the tough stance that America took in fighting what essentially was a proxy war against China, against communism and the spread of communism in Korea, setting such a strong statement has actually benefited the regime of what was then Kim Il-sung and now Kim Jong-un, because the tactics that the Americans took to push back this invading force in South Korea was extreme. The bombing was amazingly destructive.
This, I think, is probably the most interesting message for Americans to take away from reading this book. When North Korea attacked South Korea, the Americans were caught with their pants down militarily. They didn't have good ground forces in South Korea or in the region, and it took them a while to build up the ground forces. But it didn't take long for the Americans to bring their B-29 bombers and bomber pilots and bombs into the theater and go to work on North Korea. North Korea had no way, really, of fighting back against American bombs. And the philosophy of the U.S. Air Force at the time was, if you have lots of bombs, drop them. And the Americans began just a few weeks after the invasion of South Korea, and they bombed North Korea almost daily for 3 years. They destroyed about 85% of the structures in the country, if you could believe that. Imagine what that would be like in the United States if 85% of the structures were bombed. And up to 20% of the population was killed by the bomb. What this did is it destroyed North Korea, its infrastructure, and badly damaged its capacity to do anything. But it also gave Kim Il-sung and his descendants exactly what they need. All dictators need an evil monster enemy that they can demonize and say, we can protect you from these baddies out there, but in return, you're going to have to sacrifice a lot. You're going to have to put up with repression, with poverty, with isolation. And for the North Koreans, it's really based on a fact-based narrative. Almost everybody in North Korea remembers the bombing of the country. They know that those bombs killed their grandma. And when the Kim family says that unless we protect you, the Americans might come again and kill your grandma again, there's a certain emotional and factual resonance to that claim that continues to give the government legitimacy. And Americans are completely unaware of it.
And that's why when you see the North Korean government pour so many resources into the development of a nuclear program and that they have a nuclear bomb, what that means to North Koreans is maybe that a level of protection that goes back to the 50s.
They genuinely see it that way as a way of protecting themselves. And the reason they see it that way in part is because of the propaganda genius of the Kim dynasty. They've blocked out most alternative narratives. I think if there was a general free flow of information, the North Koreans would realize that the Americans, they're not bombing Japan. They have a good relationship with Japan and with other enemies. Wars are awful. And then countries see the future, and they react accordingly. The Americans' relationship with Vietnam is quite normal, with trade relations and strong diplomatic relations. But it's in the interest of the Kim dynasty to keep everything with the Americans on a war footing.
So at the time when Nokam-suk stole the MiG fighter, flew it from North Korea to South Korea, this must have been a major upset to the image of what Kim Il-sung thought of as his military power. This is, of course, after the armistice was signed, so the war was over. In principle, of course, there were still plenty of forces on either side. What was the reaction that Kim Il-sung had that we know of?
Well, he was very, very embarrassed. We know that because on the day that Nokam-suk stole the plane, which was September 21st, 1953, the great leader, Kim Il-sung, was having a fancy dinner in Moscow with the post-Stalinist leaders of the Soviet Union. And at that dinner, he had been feted for his genius in fighting against the Americans in the Korean War. And they'd given him tens of millions of dollars to help rebuild his bombed-out country. And the Soviet leadership also said that he was comparable to George Washington in the American Revolution in setting the stage for freedom and prosperity in North Korea going forward. So it was really one of the most wonderful nights of his life. And then he wakes up the next morning to find out that this insolent 21-year-old fighter pilot had stole the prized military possession that he had, which was a MiG, and given it to his archenemy. So it was an extremely bad day, and he came back in a very bad mood. He never actually publicly acknowledged the theft, nor did the Soviet Union, but Kim Il-sung did kill five of the pilot colleagues of Nokam-suk as punishment. He would have killed his family, but his father was dead and his mother had already come to South Korea, so there was no one else to punish.
The two men were, in a way, face-to-face at one point prior to the defection. They'd actually been in the same location twice, but there was a period where Kim was right in front of Nokam-suk.
What happened is that after No learned how to fly a MiG, he was in one of the first groups, actually, that went into battle in a MiG. He took the plane, along with seven other pilots, to an airstrip not far from where the great leader and his family were staying. And they parked the planes, and the great leader came there and inspected the whole bunch and walked around and was just a few feet from Noh Kaum Suk. Noh Kaum Suk was in his flight uniform, and he had a service revolver, you know, on his side in a holster. And he thought, you know, if I just pull out this pistol and pluck a few bullets into this guy's belly, it would shorten the war and do everybody a whole lot of good. And he thought about it very seriously for a few seconds, but then he said, well, they would just shoot me, even if I was successful. And it would be a bold statement that I would be dead and I would never get to America. So he didn't do it.
So there was a colorfully named plan to bribe North Korean pilots to do exactly what Noh did. Who dreamed up this idea of offering basically a reward for defection?
Yeah, it was called Operation Moolah, a typical name from the 1950s, and it offered $100,000 to the first red pilot, be he Russian, North Korean, or Chinese, with the moxie to get in a MiG and bring it to a U.S. Air Force base. And $100,000 at that time was worth roughly about $1 million. So it was a lot of money. The Americans who dreamed it up, it apparently came from a journalist who was having drinks with a general, and then the general thought it was a good idea and implemented the plan. The plan was put in place in the last few months of the Korean War, and the Americans dropped millions of leaflets all across North Korea, hoping that pilots would see the leaflet, and they also did radio broadcasts. Noh Kaum Suk, who was planning to leave, never heard the broadcast, never saw the leaflets. But when he landed at Gimpo Air Force Base with the MiG, this was 7 weeks after the war was over, but the Americans automatically assumed, in the American-centric way, that the guy had come for the moolah. And they said as much to him. They hinted obliquely. They said, oh, you're a rich man now. You can afford to buy 30, 40 cars if you'd like. And he didn't know what they were talking about. For about a day, he just was completely baffled by all these references to his newfound wealth. Then he found out about it, and he said, well, if they're going to give me all this money, I'll take it. But that's not why I came. But what was really interesting is Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was president of the United States at the time in the first year of his presidency, he also found out about Operation Moolah on that day when the North Korean arrived. And Dwight D. Eisenhower didn't like the idea of giving taxpayer money to a commie thief. So he wrote a memo to his staff which said, let's find a way to persuade this pilot not to take the money, because I'm afraid that if he takes it, he'll spend it on wine, women, and song. and so the Americans did. They put pressure on Noh Kaum Suk for the better part of a year, telling him that maybe you don't need this money, maybe you should say you don't want it. And at one point, he agreed. He said, you know, I didn't come here for the money. I can make money. I'm a smart guy. So he said, I will go to a press conference and say I don't want the moolah. But before the press conference could be held, the higher-ups in the Air Force had been pestered so much by American reporters who wanted to meet the moolah man and wanted to see the check. And the whole idea of giving money to the pilot had sort of captured the imagination of the American press, and the Air Force decided that they would look like really cheapskates if they denied the money to this young pilot. So they agreed to give it to him, but they gave it to him only very slowly in a trust, and he actually did not have complete access to that money for 20 years. The silver lining is during that time he came to the United States, became a successful aeronautical engineer, had a really great career, and he learned how to manage his money. He never spent Operation Moolah to this day. He's 83 years old, and he's become a good conservative investor, and he has all that money earning interest in the market, and he's a wealthy man now.
And he lives in the United States. Where is he? Is he in Florida?
He lives in Daytona Beach.
In Daytona Beach. He changed his name.
Changed his name to Kenneth Rowe.
And one day, he called you.
One day, he called me. He called me. I wrote a book about North Korea in 2012, and he read it, and he called me up, and he said, told me his name, both of his names, and he said, do you know who I am? And I said, no. And he said, well, if you think you know anything about North Korea, you should find out who I am. So I did, and called him back and asked him to participate in this book, and he was really delighted. I think one of the things that had happened to him, he was very famous in 1953 and 1954. He was, you know, above the fold, front page news around the world. But the world has forgotten about his courage and his fascinating story, and he was pleased to tell it again.
Blaine Harden is the author of The Great Leader and the Fighter Pilot, which tells No Cum Sucks story, and the story of the founding of what we now think of as the totalitarian and isolationist North Korea. Blaine, thanks so much for talking to us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.